Hello, and thank you for joining us for Catholic News, read by Chris Mihalik. The source of our program is DenverCatholic.org. A life of faith and valor, Edward Mora's journey through service and reflection by Shara Terrell. Edward Mora III, known as Eddie, embodies a deep understanding of faith and connection. A naval veteran and retired engineer, he recently celebrated his 81st birthday, reflecting with gratitude on God's guiding presence throughout his life. His military service, steeped in his Catholic faith, was a testament to shared beliefs among the armed forces. God and country, that was pretty much a common belief, not just with Catholics, but anybody that was a person of faith and was part of the military, he said. I also believe that Mary has been given special graces, so this is my way of saying, I do what I do for God. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, Mora grew up as an only child. After high school, he earned a bachelor's degree in architecture from the University of Detroit in 1967. Following graduation, he enlisted in the Navy and attended Officer Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island, before being commissioned into the U.S. Naval Reserve on March 8, 1968. He served in the Gator Navy, specializing in amphibious warfare, and received additional training at the Philadelphia Navy Base, including damage control and SERE, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape School. SERE School trains military personnel, especially those at risk of capture, to survive in hostile environments, evade capture, resist interrogation, and escape captivity. It focuses on survival skills, evasion tactics, and resistance methods. Since many of these classes were held by Navy SEALs, they adopted Mora as one after he trained with them. Mora served on USS Sandoval, an attack transport ship in the Mediterranean before ships decommissioning in 1970. After his naval service, Mora worked as an architect for 35 years in Michigan and Colorado, contributing to the design of buildings at the University of Northern Colorado. He retired around 2005 to care for his ailing mother, Ruth, following the death of his father, Eddie, in 1996. Reflecting on his service, Mora notes the challenges soldiers face, including the harsh realities of beach landings during wartime. Imagine 36 soldiers or Marines in each boat, with two Navy guns driving. One of them had a machine gun to fight back against the opposing forces on the beach. As you approach the beach, the first half dozen soldiers are staring at the inside face of that steel ramp, watching it tattooed by enemy machine guns, he said. He further captured the immense courage of soldiers, adding, those brave guys knew that within seconds the ramp would drop, and there was a strong possibility they'd be mowed down like weeds in the field. Most casualties during beach landings happen in the first 15 to 20 minutes. That's the reality of what these men faced. With such intense challenges, returning from service is far from easy. Mora also witnessed firsthand the struggles of returning veterans, recognizing signs of PTSD and homelessness. I began to realize they were actually suffering from PTSD. I don't know how many times I've seen someone on a street corner clearly homeless. Why were they homeless? And why were they on a corner in the United States of America begging for food, he said. He reflected on the sacrifices of service members, emphasizing, when you went into the service, what you did was make an unknown promise to Uncle Sam that if necessary, you would have your life taken voluntarily. Mora stressed the deep cost of conflict, stating, the best kind of war is the one that's never fought and that the sword makes peace. As a veteran and a devoted parishioner at St. Michael the Archangel Parish in Aurora, Mora participated in last year's In God We Trust Mass and Luncheon. The event offered more than spiritual nourishment. It provided a vital sense of community with fellow veterans. Moore found this ministry a blessing, connecting with others who understand the profound need for such support. I thought it was just going to be essentially a mass, and I'd have the opportunity to meet some veterans who are all tied together with the concept of God and country. I was one of a whole bunch of people. A lot of them were veterans, and obviously veterans' families and friends. And again, I felt very humbled to be a part, but I was a little teeny part of that, he recounted. Moore valued connecting with veterans, many of whom later became deacons, finding their personal stories a meaningful glimpse into life shaped by service. For him, these encounters were windows into experiences resonating with shared values. I always enjoy talking to veterans because regardless of their branch or era of service, every veteran, man or woman, enlisted or commissioned, has a unique story, and that to me is fascinating, he said. Moore is grateful for the Archdiocese's ministry dedicated to veterans and values and his involvement with and Godly Trust, where he shares his experiences and faith. He looks forward to future events and plans to bring more veteran friends. In a heartfelt reflection on his remarkable 81 years, Moore encapsulates his life's essence with a powerful symbol of faith and patriotism. As he contemplates his experiences, he proudly points to the Marion medal he wears and asserts, "My medal, representing the Immaculate Heart of Mary, symbolizes both God and country to me. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it." Vatican II at 60, Lumen Gentium, signaled a historic call to live holiness by Father Joseph Thomas of the National Catholic Register. The universal call to holiness is a signature teaching of the Second Vatican Council. The topic forms the subject of the fifth chapter of Lumen Gentium, the Council's dogmatic constitution on the Church. With this text, Vatican II stated decisively that all the faithful of Christ of whatever rank or status are called to the fullness of the Christian life and to the perfection of charity. The teaching was a radically new pronouncement, at least in the context of solemn declaration by the Church. The topic also had a certain novelty within the Council itself. A chapter dedicated to the call to holiness was not present in the initial draft of Lumen Gentium presented at the beginning of the Council. This earlier text, after describing the hierarchy of the Church, dedicated a chapter to the states for acquiring evangelical perfection, that is, the religious life. In the spring of 1963, in a meeting of the Commission for Coordinating the Council's Work, Belgian Cardinal Leo Joseph Sunens presented the suggestion for a specific chapter dedicated to the topic of holiness in the Church. He took as his starting point the earlier text on the state of perfection, understood in the sense of the religious life. The Belgian prelate felt that this earlier chapter had put too much emphasis on the superiority of the religious state, and that a wider vision was needed. He proposed that the Constitution on the Church might first describe the vocation to holiness that is directed to all Christians, and then move on to portray that which is proper to the state of perfection specific to the religious. The proposal would reflect in a new chapter that was presented to the Council Fathers in the fall of 1963, entitled On the Vocation to Holiness in the Church, which covered both the call to holiness in general and a specific call to holiness within religious life. Recalling Christ's call to be perfect in charity in Matthew 5:48, and the teaching of Doctor of the Church, St. Francis de Sales, this draft affirmed that all Christians of whichever state are called to the common goal of Christian holiness as a fruit of the actions of God's grace. During the debates in this text, the Council Fathers were in agreement on the need to proclaim the call to holiness among all, to be all the baptized. Cardinal Norman Gilroy of Sydney noted this consensus within the council and further argued the council would only have success if it effectively led all of the church's members to a higher degree of holiness. At the same time, numerous council fathers would call on the text to better express the meaning of Christian holiness. Archbishop Angelo Fernandez, coadjutor of New Delhi, commented that the text was not profound enough in describing the meaning of Christian holiness as a perfect growth of the grace of adoption and transformation in the Holy Spirit brought about in baptism. Furthermore, he observed that the text gave disproportionate space, almost 70%, to matters related to the religious life, while recognizing the special role of the religious in giving testimony to the church's unstained holiness. He called on the council to give more attention to the call to holiness of bishops, priests, and the laity, in addition to a clearer articulation of the essential meaning of the religious vocation. These and other similar suggestions were in no way intended to take away from the council's veneration for the religious life. As Croatian Bishop Stjepan Borlin pointed out, the diocesan priest's dedication to God differs from that of the religious, like one star from another differs in splendor. Yet the difference in splendor would not be a reason for denying the existence of a star. The various suggestions of the Council Fathers were reflected in an extensively revised text on the call to holiness presented to the Council in the fall of 1964. Here, for the first time, the Council Fathers were presented with a text on the universal call to holiness in the Church, which could potentially be a chapter unto itself. The Assembly would later vote to approve this text as a specific chapter while also deciding in favor of another chapter on the special role of religious life in the Church. In this revised text, the Doctrinal Commission, the committee with the responsibility for revising the text, greatly enhanced the description of the meaning of the call to holiness directed to all Christians. The chapter has a new beginning, which recognized that the Church is indefectibly holy. In this way, the Council text responded to the request of many Council Fathers that the document might better express the way to call to holiness is rooted in the very identity of the Church. The new draft also contained a description of the way holiness is made a living reality in the life of the Christian. In the final text of Lumen Gentium would affirm through baptism and faith that the followers of Christ truly become sons of God and sharers in the divine nature. In this way, they are really made holy. At the request of still another Council Fathers, so as to avoid falling into pure idealism, the text would go on to recognize the reality of sin. Surely, we all offend in many things, and we all must daily pray, forgive us our debts. The chapter would also avoid such idealism by a much more detailed description of the manner in which the various members of the Church are called to live out holiness through their personal circumstances as bishops, priests, deacons, married couples, and Christian parents, as well as widows and single people. The Council wanted to make a particular mention of those who engage in labor, and frequently it is of heavy nature, all those who are weighed down with poverty, infirmity, and sickness, as well as those who must bear various hardships or who suffer persecution for justice's sake. This panorama of holiness in the Church particularly manifests the renewed consciousness of the roles of the laity in the Church, the subject of the previous chapters of Lumen Gentium. With such great variety, the members of the Church seek a common denominator, charity. The Doctrinal Commission was aware, as it noted it in presenting the revised draft to the Council, that charity is a principal and necessary way to holiness, in which all other ways are included and surpassed. This historic chapter comes to a close. with a final invitation to all the faithful to seek holiness and perfection in their own proper state. In this call, the Council noted, is in fact an obligation deriving from that mystery of the Church that it so powerfully presented in Lumen Gentium. The exhortation continues to resonate today as a summons to Christians to live according to grace they have received, each one according to the particular vocation they have received, and in this way, make Christ present in the world. A Time for Prayer, 40 Days for Life Fall Campaign begins September 25th by Marie O'Neill. In a world filled with challenges to life everywhere, we're called to be a light to the nations, a testament to the abundant life Christ offers. This fall, join a global movement to end abortion through the power of prayer, fasting, and peaceful community outreach through the 40 Days of Life campaign, which kicks off Wednesday, September 25th and runs through November 3rd. During these 40 days, people across the Archdiocese of Denver and beyond will come together to pray for the protection of life and to bear witness to the dignity of every unborn child. With 6 prayer locations in Fort Collins, Boulder, Denver, Aurora, Littleton, and Glenwood Springs, participants are invited to join daily prayerful gatherings outside of abortion clinics. These peaceful vigils offer a visible, compassionate presence as groups pray for babies, mothers, fathers, and even abortion workers. Through our presence, we send a powerful message of hope, love, and support to those impacted by abortion. In addition to the prayer vigil, 40 Days for Life emphasizes fasting as a key element of spiritual warfare. As Christ said, some evils can only be driven out by prayer and fasting. By offering up small sacrifices during these 40 days, we unite our efforts to God's will, asking for His grace to touch hearts and bring about the end of abortion in our community. To participate, you can attend one of the local events, which include masses and group prayer. Whether you join in prayer outside an abortion clinic or prayerfully support the effort from home, your contribution can help change lives and protect the unborn. As St. Padre Pio said, prayer is the best weapon we possess. Let us use it to fight for the most vulnerable among us and defend the sanctity of life. Choking on Rights Talk by George Weigel. In the prescient book, Rights Talk, The Impoverishment of Political Discourse, Mary Ann Glendon of the Harvard Law School warned her fellow Americans in 1993 that a public life was being degraded by the promiscuous use of the language of rights as a rhetorical intensifier in campaigns to promote this, that, or the other thing, things that the founders and framers would never have imagined to be rights. Rights Talk, Professor Glendon cautioned, sets the individual against the community as it privileges many personal autonomy. I did it my way over the common good. And that, she concluded, was going to be very bad for the American experiment in ordered liberty over the long haul. The long haul has now arrived, and the results are every bit as bad as Professor Glendon predicted. Nowhere has this descent into verbal incontinence created as malodorous a public stench as in the profligate use of the self-contradictory phrase, reproductive rights. What can that term possibly mean if we're not in Alice in Wonderland? Reproductive rights, a euphemism for abortion. Elective abortion is the willful destruction of a human being at an early stage of his or her development. How can the destruction of that human being, whose biological humanity is affirmed in high school textbooks, be a matter of exercising a reproductive right when the process in question is intended to end reproduction by expulsion from the womb for fetal dismemberment? Yet this blatantly deceptive, in fact absurd term, reproductive rights, was recently embraced by the Republican Party's presidential candidate shortly after the Democratic National Convention celebrated abortion as if it were a civic sacrament, indeed the civic sacrament, before which all must bow in worship. There is something quite sick about all this, and mutterings about the lesser of evils are of little consolation when what is being embraced as a right by the putatively lesser miscreant is, in truth, the deliberate destruction of an innocent human life, which is this side of blasphemy about as evil gets. Politics is typically downstream from culture, and if our politics have become warped to the point where the abortion license is being sacramentalized, then there is something gravely wrong with our public moral culture. How then do we rebuild a public space where truth-telling prevails over euphemism so that the serious debate replaces volleys of epithets in which each cannonading side accuses the other of violating its rights? One possible path forward lies in the recovery of the classic Catholic notion that rights are always tied to responsibilities. In that still relevant work of Catholic political theory, we hold these truths, Catholic reflections on the American proposition. John Courtney Murray, S.J., explained the linkage in these terms while exploring the deeper meaning of the rights of free speech and freedom of the press. These institutions do not rest on thin theory proper to 18th century individualistic rationalism that a man has a right to say what he thinks merely because he thinks it. The proper premise of these freedoms lay in the fact that they were social necessities essential to the conduct of free, representative, and responsible government. People who are called to obey have the right first to be heard. People who are to bear burdens and make sacrifices have the right first to pronounce on the purposes which their sacrifices serve. People who are summoned to contribute to the common good have the right to pass their own judgment on the question whether the good proposed be truly good, the people's good, the common good. When rights are severed from responsibilities, the public square becomes a gladiatorial pit in which everyone's rights claims are in a constant, often brutal, battle for survival against everyone else's. This is not democratic deliberation. It is intellectual and moral chaos, and chaos can lead to freedom's self-destruction. Thus, Murray put the danger to an American choking on contending rights claims in these elegantly dramatic terms. Perhaps one day, the noble, many-storied mansion of democracy could be dismantled, leveled to the dimensions of a flat majoritarianism, which is no mansion but a barn, perhaps even a tool shed in which the weapons of tyranny may be forged. Colonel Joseph Ratzinger said much the same thing when he raised the alarm about an encroaching dictatorship of relativism on a day before his election as Pope Benedict XVI. We are not quite there, but the persistent profligate abuse of language and reason displayed in terms like reproductive rights is hastening the day of reckoning. I'll conclude this program with some upcoming events. Rose Petal Evening with St. Therese, Friday, September 27th at 7 p.m., Praise and worship, exhortation, testimonies, enter into the way of trust and love of St. Therese of the Child Jesus and ask her intercessions with bold confidence. Please bring a self-addressed stamped envelope. For more information, contact Community of the Beatitudes at 720-855-9412. Thank you for joining us for Catholic News, read by Chris Mihalik.